Well, hello everybody. I think it's time to start. If somebody's taping, they can hit the button. This is session two. Good morning. My name is Jonathan Furex. Session two of the series, where the real title is Let Us Be Nuclear Free Someday. And the first part of the title is Saving Holden and everything else. This session I call Revisiting Doomsday, with a little parenthesis, because it never went away, so it might be nice to revisit it since it's still around. And in the time we have, I'd like to spend a bit of time on language versus reality, when there's such a discrepancy. What conclusions can we draw about something so important? The cycle of learning and forgetting, which explains nuclear history pretty well for the 65 years since the bomb was invented or used. And then the behavior within that of the need to change targets. If you're going to keep the bomb, you have to keep changing who your enemies are. And then a little bit of time at the end on the good news, which is running through this, is that there have been faithful people all around the world trying their best, you could say, to do what they can do about something that is quite befuddling if we think of ourselves as the crown of creation and the image of God. I'm going to have also a video interlude, another section from what I played last night, because I want to stop with you and listen again to the hibakusha. Hibakusha, the Japanese word for people who were there, the witnesses, the survivors, the sufferers who were there in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who will be talking to us for another 15, maybe 20 years if we're lucky. And then we won't have any witnesses anymore. So, when Obama said we can't do warrior things in his lifetime, I think he was being a little political, big political, and it would be nice for us to actually believe we could do away with them in his lifetime, because look how young he is. We need to do away with it in their lifetime. That's essentially what they're telling us. If you care to, don't do it unless you want to, or feel you should, pass this around and take a look at the photos. Doomsday. I looked up the Oxford Shorter English Dictionary, because remember this old word? It's sort of gone out of fashion. But it predates the nuclear phenomenon in a kind of a prophetic way. The definition they have is from the medieval period, I think. Maybe there's a scholar here who can be more precise. Doomsday machine or doomsday bomb, a hypothetical bomb or a device capable of annihilating the world. And it predates the nuclear history. But if you take nuclear weapons as a collective phenomenon, you could say they are the doomsday. They are the doomsday machine. We have done what somebody dreamed up in a sort of a science fiction moment a long time ago. And yet, how do we think of them? And as we talk about language and reality, I'd like you to enter into the challenge a little bit as we discuss, and feel free to interrupt with questions and comments. But how do we usually think of them? We usually think of them in terms, and without even thinking very deeply, in terms of security, in terms of national security, something admittedly terrible. Yesterday when I polled you, nobody thought we should keep them. And if you poll the public in every country in the world, except Pakistan, the public in every nuclear country, every non-nuclear country is through the roof. It's 95, 98, 100%. But every nuclear power, the eight others, we haven't pulled North Korea, so the seven others, the public wants to get rid of them at the rate of about 65%. And I'm always fascinated by the uninformed general will on the biggest questions. I think it's quite a good lead for that. Not good on specific policies, not good on getting warped one way or the other. But in Pakistan, the public wants to keep them because they feel victimized, they feel by their own government, now by nature with these horrible floods, by the earthquake 5 years ago, by the generals they've had for most of their history, by the way the U.S. jerks them around, India jerks them around. And they think nuclear weapons are a ticket to dignity in a rough, rough world.
Jonathan, have the Israelis been polled on that question? They have?
Yeah.
And there too, it's majority want to get rid of them?
Yeah. Yep. And I have a partner, a Jewish, an Israeli anti-nuclear advocate, who has signed up 42 Israeli mayors for Mayors for Peace. Mayors for Peace is an association started by the mayors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Check and see if your city is part of it, where the mayor signs up to Mayors for Peace. 4,000 cities have done so. Just Google Mayors for Peace. Sharon Dolev has gone around and signed up 42 Israeli mayors for Mayors for Peace. They had none. She's done it in like a year and a half, including the mayor of Dimona, where the Israeli
where their
main reactor is and where a lot of their bomb fuel has come from. It's just the mayor's commitment. I don't think the city council has to agree in most places, but there's room to expand. And if you want to look for local angles, which we all need to do on a global issue, you know, a local angle is your mayor a member of Mayors for Peace, he or she? Would your council join them? Would your city do something to make it real? Like, do you have a nuclear contractor? Do you have a defense contractor? There's things that you can, in a globalized economy, that we can all do. We think of them in terms of security, really terrible, but sort of we got to accept them, because after all, isn't it a tough world? Don't other people have them? And don't we have people who don't like us? So we allow them to be there. The little blurb I wrote about the session, which was meant to entice some of the younger generation, we didn't do too well. What flavor of nuclear security ice cream, nuclear security ice cream would you like? Chunky balance of terror, magnificent mushroom cloud madness, luscious low-fat launch on warning. All flavors guaranteed to include one man deciding in mere minutes whether the world as we know it will survive. Come and see if we can figure out who is fooling whom and why. So I hope at the end of the session you feel like you can think a little more clearly, maybe, than maybe you've done it already. I think your answers last night were really good, both of you who were here. But who is fooling whom and why is really what is important for us to struggle with. Balance of terror, I don't think anything needs to be said, but you know, for a country that has discovered terrorism, or rediscovered terrorism in the last 10 years, this is the best description by anybody for what we were involved in through the whole nuclear era, that we would keep the peace with a balance of terror. And it's almost sanctifying the word terror at the level of national security posture and policy. Launch on warning, this means, and I'm going to go into a little detail about it, because the terms are absurd, but what they imply is 1,000 times as absurd. And if the term doesn't leave you breathless as a moral and critical and faithful person, the implications of the term certainly will. So launch on warning, we'll go into that a little bit. Mutually assured destruction, the idea that we're safe because if we shoot at each other, the other will shoot back and nobody's going to win. And there I'd ask you to ponder an analogy, because I think the issue hides, the issue of nuclear weapons and their future in our life and in our pocketbook and in our national policy and in the way the world looks at us, hides behind all kinds of constructs and falsehoods and lies. And this is one of them. What's the analogy? And it's so complex because there's nothing else like it. What's the analogy you can think of for mutually assured destruction? The kind of the received wisdom, and this is the sentence that I have to go and get new underpants because they get too tight. The sentence that you hear all the time is, they kept the peace. Nuclear weapons kept the peace for 50 years. We should be grateful that we came through the Cold War. What understanding of the Cold War and of human nature and of world politics and of history do we allow ourselves to just slip into if we say nuclear weapons kept the peace? And I say that, you might not agree with that, because you might actually believe it. That's what most of us would believe. That's what we've been told. And I'm not saying it's not a legitimate position, but you can read it into it. It starts with what we were told about Hiroshima. We had to do that to end the war. We saved 1 million American lives. All that can be torn to pieces, very, very credibly. Was that really true, or was that a very convenient way to sell a policy that was impossible to sell, to use those weapons even on the Japanese? Would we have used them on the Germans, by the way, we Lutherans? Would we have used them on the Germans, our original opponent, who was already working on it when we started? Yes?
My dad was a volunteer veteran of U-17 that we dropped firebombs on Dresden.
Right. He was part of something very, very horrible. And I think we're in the zone of the horrible here. So it's a tough subject. But the mayor of Hiroshima, who is the leader of Mayors for Peace, a fantastic man named Mayor Akiba, he uses the analogy of nuclear weapons and how they're portrayed in politics and why they survive despite their contradictions. He said it's like parents filling their basement with gasoline but telling their children not to play with matches. That's Mayor Akiba's analogy for what the nuclear weapons dilemma is. Parents filling their basement with gasoline but telling their children, saying it's bad to play with matches. It's bad for you to play with matches. But meanwhile, you're filling your basement with gasoline. Can any of you think of an analogy? Some people like metaphors. Some people can't stand them. I like them. Anybody got one for me?
I have one for a mutually
assured destruction.
The gingham dog and the calico cat.
How is that?
Did you know the
side
by side on the table set? I can't think. But at any rate, they got into a fight, and at the end, they ate each other up. They were gone. Both of them. They were gone.
Okay. And haven't had an animal on you. That's good.
Well, it's an argument to drive a bigger car so you can kill the other person instead of get killed yourself.
But Matt doesn't say that. Matt says, you'll get killed. You have them so you won't use them. This is another beauty. You have them so you won't have to use them. You have them so you won't have to use them. And so it's not quite that. To struggle with the fact that this is two-sided, you're actually using the possession and the other's possession as a justification for a state of affairs that has enormous consequences. And we don't know how to get out of it now. I'm not saying that we all couldn't have been convinced this was the way to go during the Cold War. I think we were convinced, just to some extent. One that's occurred to me, and it doesn't quite do it, but I couldn't do any better, was it's sort of like, because the era we've been through with all the focus on suicide bombing, and we're pretending that suicide bombing is completely ununderstandable. Next week I'll tell you how I understand suicide bombing from contact with people who are in the families of suicide bombers. But the image that occurred to me was, it's like you and I put on a suicide vest, and somehow, we didn't mean it, but somehow you've got the controls for mine and I've got the controls for yours. And we're supposed to have a good relationship, or a relationship. We're supposed to get along, we're supposed to share this planet. We're the two most important people in the world. Everybody else looks up to us, but that's how we're walking around. Does that do something for you? There's a bizarre dynamic here. Have I triggered any other analogies?
Well, Quentin Tarantino used to have it in his films all the time where they would do the draw on each other and they'd just stare each other down with guns pointed at each other.
Right.
As a common theme in his films.
Yeah.
A third person came in with a gun, and a fourth person, and so it became this absurdity of all these people all pointing guns at each other.
Okay.
Who's going to pull the trigger?
Launch on warning. This is just one example of when you go into the term, what it implies. And you probably know a fair bit about this, but I think it's good to remember because it's still in force, 20 years after the Cold War for which it was put up. 20 years after the Cold War ended. What it basically requires that the U.S. president, let's see it from our point of view, and the Russians have exactly the same procedure, it's secret, but pretty much the outlines are clear. The U.S. president has to reply, has to respond to a nuclear attack before the missiles hit. You launch on the warning, you don't launch on detonation. So you don't wait to see if it's real, you don't wait to take a hit and then hit back. You hit when the hit is coming. And for that to happen with the speed that missiles fly, I think it's 15,000 or 18,000 miles an hour, at the most you have 30 minutes. But if the submarine's just out there in the Atlantic, you have 6, 10, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 minutes to make this horrendous decision, which could snowball into what we've all been told so many times you can hardly hear it. And so it breaks down into decisions and steps that all need to be taken. And roughly, you got 10 minutes to detect and confirm the launch. So satellites can do that, radars can do that, instruments do that. And the people watching those things have 10 minutes to see it and to figure out where it is and to raise the alarm. The next 10 minutes is basically to decide. We're doing the easy one here where it takes 30 minutes, where they're coming from the middle of Russia and they're crossing half the world. Not the submarine version, because that's beyond belief. And I noted that in the 10 minutes to decide, at one point, the SAC commander, the Strategic Air Command commander, they've changed the name now, he has 30 seconds to describe to the president, to brief the president on the nature of the attack. We'll sit here for a week, those of you who can stand it, and we'll just scratch our head for a week talking an hour a day. But he has 30 seconds to explain something on which life and death for many, many people depends. Then the last 10 minutes is to actually implement, carry out, and hit the button and get the missiles off before the other ones strike, because as we heard last night from one of our brothers here who's been in the military, the missiles themselves are among the many targets. So the silos would go in Wyoming. I hope you're not from Wyoming or Montana, because there are a lot of missiles targeted on you still from Russia. And I said last night the thing that I think is really worth hanging on to. Dennis Healey, the Labour Prime Minister of Britain in the early 70s, I think, said, after he left office just last year sometime, he said, I decided I was never going to push the button. I was going to attack them. But if they attacked us, I'd say, why kill another 20 million Russians? We're already going to lose how many? And I think that was a rare moment of humanity in the world we've come through.
Jonathan, where does the missile defense system or systems fit into all of this? Trying to destroy missiles in the air before they reach the target.
Yeah, I mean, I have prepared
the Cold War, did both sides have that set up to be the response rather than to target the other side?
Yeah, but launch on warning makes missile defense a secondary issue. Mm. You're not depending on it. At a certain point, the Russians realized they couldn't keep up. You know, the missile gap, which we talked about in the 60s, that wasn't true. We were killing them from the word go, and we just blew them out of the water with what we did, with our economy and our capacity. But to respond to that, they ringed Moscow with these pillbox radar stations that are about the size of a 10 Walmarts, watching the sky, linked to missile defense. And the idea was they would do their best to stop them because they couldn't match us in first strike capability. I really think it's just part of the construct. You follow the test they're still doing, you know, the idea of hitting a bullet with a bullet. I mean, every 10th test maybe sort of comes close. They're still working on it. We're still going to deploy them in the Aleutians and in Poland. You know, we're worried about North Korea and Iran. I mean, it's just a sort of a minor but incredibly strange continuation of the same mentality. There is no security for nuclear weapons. And that's why the many generals and secretaries of state, I think two-thirds of the living chiefs of staff, secretaries of state, and national security advisors have endorsed the current move started by Kissinger and Schultz and Nunn and Perry with their Wall Street Journal editorial in January of 2007, that these things have to go. Any general, pretty much, who's thinking and doesn't have a career to worry about is going to say you cannot use them. And the missile defense is just part of the quagmire. But I think we're meant to believe it. We're meant to think it's a good idea because we're supposed to be scared of these incorrigible countries who just want to get us. You know, I mean, it just feels like it's sold with that kind of argumentation. My summary of those terms and what's behind them would be, this is a completely unacceptable and unprecedented strategy on the cusp of the sort of the high-tech, high-potency, mega-violence era that we live in, that has somehow managed to be socialized and made respectable, and to live on more or less unchallenged. Live on more or less unchallenged. And on a religious side, Is it too much to say it's the epitome of a kind of a collective sin? It's the epitome of a collective sin, and it's both of omission. Omission meaning we haven't used them, but we keep having them. And commission, which we haven't used them since World War II, although many people say the U.S. uses its nuclear arsenal every time it sits down to negotiate with somebody. You know, that idea of how can you, and you might not be aware of it, but in the work that I do, that is a real factor. The sense, not that specific thing, but the idea that America is so important, has so much power, they can make life so difficult for you if you don't behave yourself, that you really have to talk to them carefully. And under the Bush administration, that was really difficult for other countries to do because they were so deeply offended by what was happening, but they couldn't really express it clearly. So things just went into like a gearbox with bolts stuck in. And we're slowly trying to get things going again now, I think, people with the change of administration here. Let's remind ourselves why we're talking about this and spend 10 minutes with the witnesses that are still alive from yesterday's video made by the Canadian. Can somebody hit the standby on button on the top of this machine here? No, on top of the projector. It's the closest one to you, I think. If the back power is on, Michael, the back switch on the back, there's a toggle. It lit up?
It sounds off.
Sounds like it's on.
Sounds good. Yeah, we probably do the blinds, maybe the lights. There's some lights there. Could somebody get that window too? There's a the door would help too. So what you're going to see here is more of this work made by the Japanese-Canadian woman whose sister got killed in the blast in Hiroshima, and she mentioned last night in the piece when you saw the swans and the sunny day before, how her sister got a new set of clothes. Those clothes are in the museum. She knows what she was wearing because those clothes are in the museum in Hiroshima. But in this portion, we have the older lady you saw talking about what happened. We cut back and forth between what was being told to us in the 50s and 60s and what the Japanese were going through as they lived on. And you'll see a man named Sumitoru Taniguchi, who I met in person in May in New York. He's 75, and he was blown off his bicycle as a 16-year-old boy, and he told the whole 189 nations sitting there at the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference his story, and he was a very, very dignified man. In this film, he's there, and he takes off his shirt. And that's the part that it's pretty hard to see. And then we get a sense from the lady I said last night who thought of killing herself as she tried to gather up the pieces of her family, literally, but didn't, and give us one of her many reasons why she's happy she didn't. No volume. Somebody hit some lights.
Oops.
Doesn't look good. Now we're there.
Yeah.
Is volume
there
controlled from here? Power's on there.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, yeah.
A lingering litigation. It's not going to be very serious. After an atomic care versus.
Well, you got to hear this. You know, think of yourself hearing this without knowing much.
Our first responsibility will be to keep our heads and get back to our jobs.
After an attack.
Each of us has a job to do. And no matter what happens, the people of the city must be fed, clothed, supplied with electricity and heat. The city must be kept alive, and it will take everything the city has to do it. You know, Fred, actually, staying in the city will help after the atomic attack is not nearly as dangerous as a lot of people think. The danger of, well, lingering radiation is not really very serious. After an atomic air burst, the danger of radiation and falling debris is over within a minute and a half.
The atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki took the Japanese completely by surprise. Their medical facilities were pretty well knocked out, yet the deaths attributed to the bomb's radioactivity made up a small part of the total, about 15%.
This is a picture of him as a boy.
The manifestations of radiation in the body are many and range from slight to severe. Loss of hair, nausea, bleeding, inability of the body to resist other ailments that make it all repair. These are some of them. And there may be climax by the ultimate symptom, death itself. However, complete recovery is more powerful.
どうしようとどうかとかっておっしゃったので、盲腸の傷口が 妹に聞いてみて、あ、そうじゃならばそれ抱えてこの箱に入れなさい、手洗いのせて稲瀬山をしたら火葬場に連れて、急いでトモトモと火葬場に連れて行きました。お骨に来て持って帰った私は一人ぼっちになって、私も死のうと思いました。失踪式の列車の前に立つ、でもポーッという音とシュッシュッという容器の音で怖くて飛び抜けました。また立つ、飛び抜く、どうしても死ぬことができません。私たちは死ぬ容器、生きる容器、この2つを並べられる、どうしても生きることに負ける、食べるものがない、貧しさに負け、病気をしても病院に行けない、病気に負け、母を失って死ぬ勇気を選ぶ人。でも私は次の列車を待って、あ、そうだ、私が死んだら誰も他に花をあげる人いなくなるな、ならば生きていこうと思いで生きる勇気を選びました。
そんなことがあったんですが、今までにね、もう10回入会となったんです。そのうち3回は危篤状態ですからね。その危篤状態も原爆を受けた1、2ヶ月の間なら分かるんですよ。もう11年は経った、原爆を受けて18年だ、23年経っとるのに原爆症で今晩死にますと、危篤状態、親戚を見直しなさい。
The human body withstands continued exposure to small radiation doses. It is when the rate of delivery is high, or the total dose in a short period is large, that recovery cannot keep pace with damage. Exposure of a whole body in a short time to 600 or more Rankins of radiation will almost certainly be fatal.
If this should happen, it would be a tragic thing for those injured, no matter how small the number. Whether these statistically very few casualties can be justified is a personal value judgment outside the scope of this report. Each citizen must make his or her own evaluation.
その日よりも3倍ぐらい多く、もう半分ずつぐらいになります。死んだ。そういう数字が僕らは報告されたんだから、普通の爆弾とは違うわけだ。放射線の障害のあれ、死ぬまで続くんですから。
We put the finger squarely upon one of the major factors in the public attitude toward atomic weapons. If the penalty of devoting 85% of one's learning capacity to an agent that constitutes only about 15% of an atomic bomb destroys potential, and that's unsound. If you must worry, concentrate on the blast effect of an A-bomb, its cost and devastating. That means sudden death to those who chance to be in the way when it happens.
知ってるんですよ、自分たちで核兵器のその威力、ね、どんなものか、放射線もある、爆風もある、熱も熱線もあるね、その実験して広島の先に投下したわけですから、それも残酷なのはね、広島でウラン爆弾、マラスミラクロトリウラン、別々のね、核兵器を落として人体実験やったわけですね。
The threat of hydrogen bomb warfare is the greatest danger our nation has ever known. But tomorrow, this siren may mean the real thing. And if you hear it, as you drive in your auto, as you sit in your office, or work at your bench, wherever you are, what will you do? What will happen to you?
Okay, we can do the lights again, please, and maybe switch off the power, please. Comments or questions?
Do you know the date of the 1950s or whenever those films that you're showing?
I think they're 50s. One of them that we saw last night was 52. And I think a lot of it was occasioned by there was this fresh wave of horror when the H-bomb came along in 52. where we did it, then the Russians did it. And that's a whole new scale of destruction. But maybe some people here were present and able to remember it. What that was part of. What struck you about the anything, what the Habakkuk are saying or what the film is saying?
I noticed that they had a kind of a red hazy color over the shots where they were describing what could happen and to be afraid. And you know, the red at that time, I think, was the color we thought of for communism.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Okay, very observant. Yeah. Other comments? Yeah.
I was in Honolulu when there was a test of blast at Johnson Island, and it occurred in the evening, well after dark, and the entire town of Waikiki was completely daylight. There was no, and then red, and the entire horizon.
Wow. That's, I think it's 1,500 miles away.
Yeah, it was amazing. I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
Well, just, you know, there's that one scene where you have the two men who are talking about possibilities and so on, and the fact that it's men, they're sitting there smoking their pipes, I mean, there's this incredible sense of rationality, intelligence,
and it's
very much a disconnect, but it's very non-emotional. So you can see that it's a little bit like two doctors. You know, these are people with authority, there's a sense of safety and control, they know what they're doing. I mean, it's just so classic.
The one-liner that struck me was these radiation symptoms, where they're showing the body as if it was a machine. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe climaxed by the ultimate system symptom.
Yes.
But far more likely is recovery. And then the 15% from radiation is a complete lie. The idea that only 15% of the deaths. The Japanese guy says what I understand to be true from different kinds of media. It's actually two or three times the number killed by the blast. So to say that, obviously they're very worried about our worry about radiation, you know, trying to calm the public down about radiation. And the other thing that struck me is the biggest threat we face is the atomic bomb, the hydrogen bomb. The enemy doing it to us. It's all about the enemy. It's all about the threat to us. Where have you heard that before? Yeah.
It felt kind of contradictory to me because, you know, when they put the pie chart up with 85% worried but 15% only are hurt, and so the odds were looking pretty good for us. And then those two men that, you know, everything's cool, and then at the end they show the husband and wife looking at each other, because it's really a personal decision, and if you're driving in your car, what will you do? I mean, it feels like it was okay for them, but what are we going to do if it happens to us? The emotionalism kind of ended that, in my opinion, by that husband and wife looking at each other like, what the hell are we going to do?
Well, the fact that they say that, I mean, to me, it's almost nefarious to pretend you can do anything.
Yeah.
Like the stop drop and whatever that comes
out. The newspaper over
here. Yeah, the newspaper last night.
Yeah. I was a teenager. In the early 50s. And
no.
I will, yes. But I remember the duck and cover, you know, get under your desk.
Yes, in school.
What an absolute insane thing.
Yeah.
Well, it was
to
so
think
insane.
That could help.
They stopped doing civil defense drills like that
right.
In the 60s and 70s because it became so ridiculous
yeah.
In the face of such overwhelming destruction.
It was Robert Oppenheimer who expressed remorse
right.
At having developed the atomic bomb, and yet a few years later, Teller push for the hydrogen bomb.
Mm-hmm.
What insanity.
Yeah.
Remember in the 60s people, my best friend's parents had a choice, build a swimming pool or a bomb shelter.
Yes.
They built a bomb shelter. Well, we were bombed. Now we were thinking of building bomb shelters on the way home from school because we had a long way to get home from school, so we were going to put oil barrels in the ground. We never did.
What is the actual date of that bombing?
Which one?
Hiroshima.
Hiroshima is August 6, 1945. We just had the 65th anniversary. Yes. And Nagasaki, which is actually a stronger bomb, but it was a bit off course, and it landed on the other side of a ridge from downtown, so it killed less people. It was August 9th. 3 days later, we had to teach them a lesson again, you know. So all those people were dead. The ones you're seeing here are from both cities. Taniguchi, the guy with the shirt off, he's from Hiroshima.
That comment that they said about a human experiment using plutonium on one and uranium on the other, that is a horrendous thought.
The round, big round one they showed second cut, that's Fat Man. That's the Nagasaki bomb. That was a plutonium bomb. So they got to try them both. And the first one was Little Boy, the Hiroshima bomb.
That's all they had developed at the time, wasn't it?
Well, the first one was in Alamogordo, New Mexico, about 3 months earlier, where they actually proved they could do it.
Yeah.
And that's where, at the Trinity bomb site, you can go there. But all of these things, I just want to say, they're important. Even if you had these wacky experiences, it was a link to the issue. And I think what's interesting to ponder, there's no link to the issue today for most people.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your kids have no connection, even to the twisted version. And I was trying to get a 28-year-old corporate lawyer who's on our central committee at the World Council of Churches, an Armenian Orthodox from a lawyer from Los Angeles. And I was telling her a few things. And she cut me off after about 4 minutes. I thought I was doing pretty well, but she cut me off and she said, "I've grown up with a lot of threats. And there's no government that could do anything about this one anyway." And that was the end of my attempt to get her interested. But look at that sentence. I've grown up, the Bible study this morning, we've grown up with a lot of threats. And there's no government that could do anything about this one anyway. Is that a description of our world?
Mm-hmm. That's pretty frightening.
Yeah, but I think the first part is really interesting. Because you have. I mean, what have we all done? We've all come to terms with this. We live with it. It's hard to have this class because who wants to sit and talk about this? It's your vacation, for goodness sake. Mine too. But will you hear this back where you live?
No.
And let me get really cheeky. Would your church ever bring it up? Some of you would, I think, but most of us wouldn't. And why is that? Well, we're coping. We feel we can't do anything about it. But the problem is nobody's doing anything, pretty much. So we have to get rescued by the likes of Henry Kissinger, you know? The guy who sat through any number of war crimes and been party to any number of crimes against humanity. And he gets late in life, he joins these other four horsemen, and they sign this editorial on that. But the critical thing. Now, just say one more thing. Take some faith in this, and I really can testify this from the work we're able to do there with the governments in Geneva. This current change towards a questioning again, it is so powerful because this is such a house of cards. You know, this whole weapon system and what it does is so completely unacceptable and so propped up and created by lies that it's actually very, very vulnerable. Even though we think we can't do anything, it's actually very, very vulnerable to the ultimate collapse that will be coming. I don't think God means for us to destroy this world as some sort of a lesson to the rest of the universe that God's love can be thwarted ultimately by one group. I really don't think that. But in the meantime, we're giving him a pretty good scare. And but he may not be, or she may not be as scared as we think, because it really is a house of cards. And even the nuclear powers, in conversations you have with their representatives, speak of the way the ground is shifted under their feet just by those editorials, and especially by Obama's speech last year in Prague. If you want to do some homework, go and look up April 5th, Prague, 2009, and read what Obama said. It's like, holy smokes. The main line was, as the only country that's ever used these things, we have to lead in getting rid of them. I don't think any U.S. president had ever said that. They'd all said good things about getting rid of nuclear weapons. But I don't think anybody took the responsibility that way. Sir, you had a comment.
You were just saying that you thought the subject of nuclear proliferation would not be brought up because we've all learned to cope with it. I think that it's a symptom of resignation that's grown out of, I think we all feel completely powerless. Mm-hmm. And I see that not just in this realm, but sort of across the political spectrum.
True.
I think politics has become such a juggernaut of its own that we no longer feel any connection to decision making.
Yeah. Sure.
Jonathan, the last flurry of concern that I recall in the U.S. and maybe worldwide too, in terms of public policy discussion, I think was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what caused that. Was it Reagan's meeting with Gorbachev that produced that, or was that meeting a result of the flurry of public concern? Do you remember what was going on there historically?
Yeah.
In the 80s?
Let's take that and a couple other incidents when that happened. In the 80s, the writing was on the wall, and Gorbachev's arrival on the other side was, I think, critical.
Yeah.
Reagan already always had a kind of a deep feeling that these things were not good. They were not nice. And as things shifted in the Soviet Union, remember they had Andropov for a while? Brezhnev and those guys died. Andropov was real short. There was another one for, like, Chernenko or somebody. And then Gorbachev. And he started his glasnost. And you could say glasnost is what nuclear weapons don't need. They don't want transparency. They don't want thing. And so I think he gets a lot of credit. But the absolute highlight was 1989 in Reykjavik. Anybody remember that? I don't know if I can spell it, but where for about 6-7 hours, Gorbachev and Reagan sat down in that little White House somewhere outside of Reykjavik and basically considered abolishing them.
Yeah.
And there's a beautiful comment about what they said at the end there in this book, which I tried to order, but the order got lost. But if you want to buy a really good book, buy this book, Seventh Decade by Jonathan Schell, The Seventh Decade of the Nuclear Age. And he describes how they would throw a party for the world, come back 10 years after their agreement, or 20 years, when the last nuclear weapon was dismantled, and throw a party for the world. And it failed. Reagan agreed and Gorbachev agreed. But the U.S. wouldn't give up its Star Wars. We wouldn't give up our missile defense. And you can see them, they're in some of the films like that, walking away, and Gorbachev looks pretty sad, and Reagan's kind of biting his lips and saying, no, I can't give up Star Wars. So at the end of the day, we were the stronger party, but we refused to go all the way. And could they have made it pass? Margaret Thatcher came to the White House in a flash and said, what the hell are you guys doing? Are you gone crazy? George Shultz talks about what Margaret Thatcher, how she reacted when she told Reagan. Nobody could believe they'd actually done it, but that was at the peak of the period you're talking about. And I think it's the slippage of the Soviet Union, the realization that they weren't able to keep us together. Because remember, they made tremendous sacrifices to try to keep up on the arms race as a much poorer country. Mm-hmm. So you have a period of rising alarm and concern for disarmament then, which peaked with that agreement, and in which we got the first START agreement, which was a pretty good one. The other highlights, anybody remember highlights and lowlights of the nuclear history? Let's just put a few dates on the map. This is the late 80s. The other thing I think I would say is that in the early 80s, you had the nuclear freeze movement. You had mass mobilization against the weapons, especially in Europe, because of the tactical nuclear weapons, which at that point, NATO's strategy, and Colin Powell was a commander in some of this, and he talks about it quite frankly now and says, get rid of them. But NATO couldn't match the Soviet conventional forces, so to with the number of soldiers and tanks the Russians had. So they said, we'll stop you with tactical nuclear weapons, which are really just nuclear weapons, many times more powerful than Hiroshima, and what's tactical about them. But they're on short-range missiles, and even they had them on artillery. They had artillery. You saw them last night at the end of the cut. A big artillery that could shoot a nuclear shell. And that would be what would repulse the Russians. And Colin Powell says, if we did that, would that mushroom into a nuclear war, or would the Russians say, okay, sorry, we'll turn our tail, turn tail, and go back? There was a huge protest about stationing those weapons in Europe, Pershing missiles and so on, and some protests over here.
There was a much earlier period, though, that I remember as a young married one with a child, And that was the Bay of Pigs. I was absolutely terrified.
Yeah.
Terrified.
62.
62, yes.
Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
Right.
And if
following
you...
the Cuban Missile Crisis, there's today letters, private correspondence between Khrushchev and Kennedy, and both were amenable to the reduction of atomic weapons.
Yeah. Well, they did, the Kennedy did a lot of the work for the partial test ban treaty, which came in 63. So this spooked a lot of people. You know what the Latin Americans did? They went off and started the world's first nuclear weapon-free zone. They said, from Mexico south, we don't want anything to do with these things. You can't put them here, you can't test them here, we're not going to let you base them, we're not going to ever get them. And that's a movement which has now encircled the whole world in the Southern Hemisphere. I want to talk about that a bit, because we've put some time and had some success with that as an ecumenical family of churches. But the Cuban Missile Crisis led to real scare. And you have, in 1970, the treaty, which you should leave this, you're going to be tested in the final exam, so get your pencils. 1970 is the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And it's real simple. It's got three things. It says, none of you guys, I'm a nuclear power and you're a non-nuclear, you're all non-nuclear powers. I get to keep my weapons. You can't have yours.
Mm-hmm.
You can't ever have them. I have them and I can keep them, but I'll get rid of them someday. No timeline. I'll get rid of them someday. And all of us can do nuclear energy. We can all do nuclear power stations. So Iran is standing on that third pillar.
Yeah,
they have the right. Absolutely have the right. Under the treaty, they have the right. It's an old treaty. It's an amazing bargain between the powerful and the many. And it has this deal. You can't ever have them, and you guys all agree that you'll never have them. But why do you think you agree to that? Because I say, in Article 6, eventually complete disarmament.
Did they all sign all of the
189
nuclear?
Yeah. Well, India didn't sign because they were already working on the bomb. Pakistan didn't sign because India didn't sign, and Israel didn't sign because it was thinking it has to look after itself all by itself. North Korea was in it, they signed it, and they pulled out in 2001. Nobody slapped their hands. Dysfunctional system, they let them go. When they meet now, that North Korea's nameplate, when this treaty meets, they meet almost every year, the chairman takes North Korea's nameplate and keeps it. Because they don't want to admit that North Korea pulled out, because it would show that the treaty is cracking.
And did Iran sign?
Absolutely. Yeah. Everybody signed. 189. Five nuclear powers signed on article of the first pillar, the other signed on the second pillar, and everybody gets to have the third pillar, the nuclear energy thing. So that's the high point of disarmament. It's the most widely subscribed disarmament treaty in history. It's the most important one in history, you could say. But it's hit hard times. Why? The nuclear powers will tell you, and that's what you've been hearing for the whole last 10 years, it's hit hard times. Why? Because people are proliferating. You know, smoking is bad for you. Smoking is bad for you. Smoking is bad for you. You can't smoke. You're not allowed to smoke, and you can't start smoking. You know, that's the nuclear, that's NPT politics. Is that incredible? That's what Iran. You're Iran. And I'm smoking, and I tell you, you can't smoke, you know?
You buy tobacco stocks then, right?
Yeah, on the side.
Doesn't the nuclear proliferating countries benefit from, I mean the powers benefit from the fear of the two countries that they're saying are making it? I mean, because they could say, we have to keep on because there's these people are going to do it. These are bad people. Iran and...
Yeah, absolutely.
So as long as they keep cooking up information that's saying that they're making it, are they? Are they really?
I think the best bet on Iran is it's doing what Japan has done. Japan, you know, the people who've been bombed, they could make a nuclear weapon next week. They live in a tough neighborhood too. Isn't the whole world tough if that's how you want to see things? China's next door, Korea doesn't like them. All the people they occupy don't like them. They got bombed. The Buddhists and the Christians in Japan are 150% against nuclear weapons ever being in Japan's hands. And we had a meeting on a regular basis. But the government has gone right to the edge. And the edge is no big mystery. The edge is having nuclear energy and knowing how to enrich the fuel. And the bomb making after that is easy. So Iran, very, very logically, looking at the respect North Korea got for this starving poker player, North Korea, looking at how Israel manages to cut its own swath in the world, gets a double standard, gets a pass, everything it does. Why wouldn't you do it yourself? You've been picked on by the West for 150 years. 150 years. You know, BP was not BP until quite recently. It was the Iranian American Oil Company. And when they struck oil in the 1930s, they got the Shah to sign a paper saying, we have the right to this oil we found in your country, and we have the right to everything under the ground in your country. And you're an Iranian? And you think this is the way you should be treated? No. So, you know, we talk about it as if they're the next threat. We talk about the same rationale as these films from the 50s that we think are pretty hokey now. So it's like,
but isn't the truth
look in the mirror, look in the mirror.
Isn't the truth kind of ridiculous based on their own arguments? Because the truth of the matter is that we have nothing to fear from a nuclear state because of their own, you know, suicidal wish. I mean, because it's quite clear that if another state, a legitimate state, launched an attack on the United States, there would be retaliation.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make any sense based on their own logic.
It doesn't make any sense for whom?
It doesn't make any sense that we need to fear a threat from another, from proliferation from another state because of their own argument of man.
Yeah.
It's double irrational logic.
I honestly think they're so unacceptable even to the people who have to do something about them because they're in power, that the only way to justify it is by claiming the threat of the other.
I mean, the terrorist threat, I could kind of see, you know, a rogue organization like Al-Qaeda.
But deterrence is totally gone. Do you think the terrorists are deterred by my nuclear weapon?
No, heck no.
Deterrence doesn't work at all with terrorists.
Right.
It works in a bipolar system between two roughly equal powers. But now there used to be a lot of nuclear weapons in few hands. Now there are fewer nuclear weapons in many hands. And that's the trend we're going in. And back on the NPT, those meetings are spent, and they go for a month every 5 years. And they come up with the most modest consensus document you can imagine. But the argument is, what's the problem? The problem is that you guys want to have them, isn't it? You're trying to get them. That's the problem. That's what the nuclear states say. And the other 184 countries say, no, no, the problem is that you guys haven't gotten rid of them the way you said you would. Who would you believe more?
Jonathan,
but I'm powerful, so you can't laugh at me. You can't laugh at me, because I'm powerful. That's absolutely the dynamic in the room.
Are you convinced that Israel has the atomic bomb?
Absolutely. They have 300 or 400.
So, have any of them been tested?
There was a test in the South Atlantic in 1978 where two rogue states were doing their homework, Israel and the white South African regime.
And third question,
who also had the atomic bomb.
I know that as far as intellect, the Israelis are capable of developing an atomic bomb, but to what extent did the United States help?
France helped them.
France.
U.S. didn't help them. France helped them. There's a great book called I forget the name, but they have a flow chart in there, who gave what to whom. Who really proliferated? The chief proliferator is, you could say, China. Army, the enemies of India, for example, Pakistan, helping Libya, helping North Korea. But we're all part of it. There are a lot of these ups and downs. We're in and up now. You should know that. How many more ups can the world get before it does something really bad to itself? Let's make the most of this up. This alarm cycle, you've got evidence, you've got alarm, you've got response, you've got mitigation.
No, they
could
do that.
Yes?
Isn't it true that Israel does not have to tell us how they use our money, the billions we give them every year?
Our aid.
They do not have to report how they use that.
No, it is true.
So how do we know they don't use it? They've got the intellect.
Well, let's be careful about this intellect. Everybody's got the intellect to make an atomic bomb. Let's not pretend this is for the smart people.
Well, but I'm saying they've got it, so why don't they can use it to get
yeah.
money?
I don't know. We give them so much money that that's the least of our worries. We have 5 minutes. Maybe the best thing to say at the end would be that. I think it's actually the theme, and also from our discussion. remember, this isn't about, this turns into an issue that isn't, that you try to make not about you and your behavior, you try to make it about somebody else and their behavior. And so, why did, all nuclear proliferations happen because of a threat. The whole history is reaction to a threat which is turned into something more than it is, because that's the only rationale you can publicly use and mobilize your, or quiet your citizenry around. So, the first program with a weapons intent, I think it's fair to say, were the Nazis. The British started a program to react to the Nazis. So the first proliferation was the British saying, the Germans are getting it? This is in World War II. So they started a secret small program. The US is pretty much right there at the beginning too, takes over the British program and starts developing the bomb with the thought of using it against the Germans. When they began to defeat the Germans, before it was ready, they switched targets and said, we'll use it against Japan. And they actually used it against Japan. When Japan went away after being blown up and defeated and turned into our ally, whose constitution we said they can't make war anymore, that's the MacArthur got that out of them. I think the negotiation that one of the Japanese guys working on this said, MacArthur and the emperor had 11 secret meetings, and the records are available now. And basically the deal was, you can keep the emperor, but you have to promise never to make war again and put it in your constitution. So Article 9 of the Japanese constitution says, we won't make war anymore. So we couldn't keep our weapons aimed at them, we'd just beaten them. So what do? We shifted them to the Russians. Now, are the Russians the threat today? Who's our aim?
Who's the threat?
Yeah, who's our weapons aimed at? They're probably aimed at a lot of people just in case, you know. But the question you might end us, we might end with is, who are we aiming at? Who are the weapons? Who's the enemy we need to justify our possession? We justify your possession by other people's behavior, not by your choice. Who is it who's justifying us now? It could be the Russians. They could come back. They could have a crazy person. So we could keep that one somewhere there. Who would you say?
Well, some would say the Chinese, I suppose.
Chinese on the horizon, for sure.
Yeah.
And we feel so bad because they own our debt, and we're in talk to them.
Pakistan?
No.
If the fundamentalists took over.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what they talked about.
Scared of that.
Iran.
Mm-hmm. I mean, why is Iran blown up into some huge thing? Never mind Israel, never mind anything else in the region. Never mind that whole region is perpetually torqued off about the way this treaty trapped all them into being non-nuclear powers, and Israel did the wrong thing. They did the right thing, got nothing. Israel did the wrong thing, got whatever it wants. That's how it feels to every diplomat in the Middle East.
Say that one more time.
Israel didn't join the treaty,
right.
Did the wrong thing, got what it wants. Yeah. Carte blanche. And we wink, we cover it, we never talk about it. Every other country in the region, in fact, this treaty ran out after 30 years. It was going to run out in 2000. It was prolonged by a solemn agreement to make the Middle East a nuclear weapon-free zone, which is code for saying Israel needs to get rid of its weapons. Mm-hmm. The Arab League agreed to prolong the treaty, make it permanent, permanentize their second-class citizenship in the world, non-nuclear states, because of that appendix to the 1995 agreement. Have we done it?
No.
It was the key moment of the meeting that just happened in May, where Israel is mentioned in the final document, and that agreement on the region is mentioned as needing serious action. And the U.S., Hillary tore out some of her hair, she shredded one of her pantsuits, she put ashes on her, and let me pick on a man too, who could I pick on here? Anyway, we pretended that mentioning Israel was just the end of the world. Arabia had been really, really bad. But they were mentioned, and it was actually a moment of honesty for what's going on at that place. We've mentioned Iran, we haven't mentioned North Korea, but honestly, North Korea, they're playing poker, and they're winning. Because with nuclear weapons, all bets are off. You know, you think we're going to bomb them? You think we're going to go in there? So it just shows you you want the Wild West? Let these things proliferate. That's actually the best argument. Let these things proliferate and see if we can carry on as a world. What
about Al-Qaeda and the threat of a terrorist organization, not necessarily the state? I mean,
that's the main thing that you'll hear now from.
But how do we defend?
But I'm not saying it because the deterrence argument, the reason for us to have an arsenal is completely counterproductive to that.
Right.
In fact, the reason they will have it is because proliferation is happening, and for which we're essentially responsible because we won't get rid of ours, and because nuclear energy is mushrooming as a medium-term climate change response. And so with, I think, 400 nuclear power stations in the world right now, they plan to have 800 by the next 20 years more. Who's going to control all that fissile material? Some of it being highly enriched uranium, from which you can make bombs. Plutonium. Reactors that make plutonium as a byproduct. That's the connection to terrorism. So actually, the terrorist threat for us to keep our weapons it has everything to do with us keeping our arsenals. But the threat that they're using to generate public concern about this is actually the terrorist threat. And if that's true, fine. I mean, it's a possibility. But for me, it's so far down the track. It's probably the most likely actual use. But it's so far down the track of what needs to get fixed that I'm a little skeptical about it getting so much attention. If any of you are members of the ELCA, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Methodist Church, the American Baptist Church, you can be a little bit proud that church people gathering throughout these years, from the word go, from 1948, when the World Council of Churches was formed, where the world churches got together with a real burden to not be on opposite sides of a world war anymore, again, not to be too busy killing each other in future across national boundaries, even though you're both Christians. And so the idea of peace and weapons of mass destruction were right there in everybody's mind. They met in Amsterdam in 1948, and a little quote from what they said there. We'll finish with three quotes from documents that, if you're really interested, I have the compiled complete works of ecumenical statements on disarmament here. We'll auction it at the end of the show and have one ice cream cone with the price. The part that war plays in our present international life is a sin against God and a degradation of man. And the discovery of atomic and other new weapons renders widespread and indiscriminate destruction inherent in the whole conduct of modern war. They met next in Evanston, Illinois, and this is pretty cool. In 1954, in Evanston, Illinois, the churches from all over the world sitting there and scratching their heads about this problem like maybe we're doing today, came up with pretty much the basic idea that 16 years later was in this biggest treaty of all time. They came up with the parameters of that treaty, the elements of it, the idea of a sort of a trade-off. They weren't going for a utopia, going for a trade-off between those who have the weapons and those who don't, and the need to make use of this energy. Remember, nuclear energy was thought of as absolutely just a miracle. We still have some of that, and the nuclear industry loves us to think it's a miracle. Well, we know it isn't. It's here to stay for a while, but ultimately we need to be rid of that as well. And then in a really strong assembly on the issue was 1983, again, this era where there was a lot of public support, so the churches reflected that. They met in Vancouver, Canada, and they gave one of the strongest statements ever about the need, the complete unacceptability of nuclear weapons and the need to get rid of them. So in a way that people of faith meeting and thinking about this have been able to forecast where we need to go and seeing the world go in those directions. And I think that that voice of faith is actually a little bit like water for a thirsty people in the desert, because this is an issue that will not be solved by typical national interest-based politics. You could say it's the last revenge of the Treaty of Westphalia in 1684, when we started going down the track of having nation states and pretending that's how human life was meant to be organized. Well, this one has got this genie's out of the bottle, and no nation can put it back in, but all nations together can put it back in. if they think across borders, if they think for the kinds of universal goods that religions of the world can share with the public. And basically what we try to do today is take those big goals and boil them down into steps that are feasible, and then take the wide church, although it's rather latent, the wide church potential to speak truth to power and to focus on a doable goal and to make small steps towards this goal that has now been embraced at the very highest levels. Yes?
What's happened since 83? Yes, since 7 years ago.
Well, the big thing is, in the 80s, yeah, Reykjavik was at the end of the 80s. Then you get the fall of the Cold War. And what happened? I think these were so linked with the Cold War, these are the epitome of the Cold War, that people just sort of took their eye off the ball. And
it
some
left the agenda.
It know? Just left the agenda. It had a chance to come back. You know, if Clinton hadn't been doing some of the things he was doing in the White House, he could have passed that comprehensive test ban treaty.
What about the churches that you were referring to?
We've never left it. We've got a great statement from 86, from 06, 07, 08. We're working on it, but I can think of probably two or three member churches out of 350 that have anybody in their structure who's actually working on this issue. So if you guys know a retired general, legislator, scientist, doctor, teacher, human being, or not retired, who can do it on the side, we need allies, because the structures that are meant to solve this are weak right now. Nations are, governments are weak, United Nations type stuff is weak, ecumenical organizations are weak. The blood ain't getting to those limbs very well anymore. The blood is going somewhere else. So it went down, end of the Cold War, and kind of like, you know, Rip Van Winkle. And I think, you know, George Bush did us a favor by being so crazy, because he is busy trying to invent new uses for him. Excuse me, anybody voted for him, but honestly, the idea that we would have bombed that place, what was it called, where Osama was with a bunker buster, earth-penetrating nuclear weapon. And let me say, you're so kind, you're still sitting here, let me just say one more thing. What's really cool, and again, small virtues, we hope God thinks they're good when we get to the pearly gates, right? There's a norm of non-use. That's all we got to say for ourselves for the last 65 years, basically. There's a norm of non-use since Nagasaki. And you might say, so what? Well, in international affairs, you move from norms to treaties and things, and then you move sometimes to laws and actual conventions that are legally binding. So norms are not unimportant. Love your neighbor as yourself, sort of. Remember Hammurabi's code? 2,000 years before Christ, I think, where you have the first reference to a state. You can't punch his lights out because he punched your lights out. You have to let the state punch his lights out. Where the state took the place of the revenge. That's the start of the norm, you know? That's actually a norm getting the status of a government action. And there's a norm of non-use, and that's really important. So if he had bombed Al-Qaeda up there in those mountains, he would have broken the norm of non-use. And he looked a little bit close to doing that to some people. That would have been a horrible tragedy. Pray for that norm and make it into a law, basically. I'm wearing a red bracelet that only four people have asked me about in 4 months. I'm about to take it off. But it has NWC. And it says, now we can. And it's talking about the Nuclear Weapons Convention. And the ultimate solution is going to be a Nuclear Weapons Convention. We've done it with landmines. We've done it with cluster munitions. Now, the U.S. hasn't signed it. China hasn't signed it. The big guys haven't signed it. Why are the big guys the flunkies on these issues of security and not killing
people?
We're
the world bullies. We've got the power and we like it.
But having those treaties, U.S., China, Pakistan, India, the crooks, behave better. Uncle Sam shows up at the meeting and tells us how, yeah, he still hasn't signed it, but boy, all of our minds are way better than they used to be, and we don't kill as many people quite as horribly as they used to, and, you know. Anyway, norms are important. So we're going somewhere with norms, and we got to go somewhere with laws and policing, verification. Same stuff that we heard about in Epictetus. You know, education and enforcement. Did he believe in enforcement, Michael?
Yes.
Thank you. Law. Hey, by the way, there were other links this morning as you talked, I thought. And Doug's got a literature class coming up.
Yeah.
Where you find out that we're actually in league with the Mormons on this issue.
Yeah.
In a very powerful way.
Some of you know, I'm teaching Leslie Silkos now in ceremony. And on Thursday, if all goes according to plan, we're going to get the end of the novel. This is a novel, Laguna Pueblo, novelist. The Laguna Pueblo is where the uranium came from that was used at the station in Los Alamos. And that novel ends with a revelation of the main character at Trinity Site. And of course, that name Trinity Site is loaded with irony.
Yeah.
Just loaded with irony. That's where the novel ends.
There are no books, yeah.
So they're all out.
They were yesterday.
Oh, okay. Well,
thank you for your attention.
There should be a copy in the library.